This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning, and we made it to Friday. That's awesome. Thanks for listening to the program. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I'd like to begin with a statement that Archbishop Corleone of San Francisco released in the last, yesterday I believe it was. And this is in response to things going on with the traditional Latin Mass. And I think this speaks for itself. This is available at the website for the Archdiocese of San Francisco, sfarchdiocese.org. The Archbishop writes, in response to a request from a group of the faithful in the Archdiocese of San Francisco in June, I agreed to allow a monthly First Wednesday celebration of the traditional Latin Mass in the Cathedral of St. Mary of the Assumption. The request having been received and granted before the issuance of Pope Francis's Motu Proprio Traditionis Custodes, the first of the monthly Masses was celebrated on July 7th, the 14th anniversary of Pope Benedict XVI, motu proprio summorum pontificum. Since Pope Francis issued Traditionis Custodes, I have been grieved by certain disrespectful responses. Some have even included slanderous attacks on the pontiff. I support Pope Francis and his concerns that those who are drawn to the more traditional forms of Catholic worship also affirm the validity of the Novus Ordo form of the Mass, and indeed of the Second Vatican Council itself. As the visible head of the Church, the Pope has a global vision of Church life and can perceive things that we cannot from our more local perspective. I also support the other concern Pope Francis articulates in his accompanying letter to the bishops, but has been overlooked by many in these recent discussions, his denouncing of widespread liturgical abuses. Such abuses have been condemned by various levels of church leadership for decades now, yet they continue. In addition to satisfying the legitimate desire of some Catholics, then, the traditional Latin Mass can also serve as a reference point to enhance the celebration of the Novus Ordo Mass. Pope Francis is concerned with preserving unity. While celebrations of the traditional Mass will continue, the focus on unity must always be before our eyes in every celebration of the Mass, in whichever form or rite. In addition, greater attention and effort must be placed on restoring dignity, reverence, and a sense of the sacred in the celebration of the Mass, of Masses, according to the current edition of the Roman Missal. Especially now, it is incumbent upon all Catholics to show respect to the Holy Father and as well as patience and understanding toward each other regardless of the form in which one chooses to worship. As I said, when the Motu Proprio was published July 16th, the Mass is a miracle in any form. Christ comes to us in the flesh under the appearance of bread and wine. Unity under Christ is what matters. And that is the total of his statement. And it's worth your knowing about it, whether or not you live in the Archdiocese of San Francisco, of course. I would encourage you to take a look at that. It's available on the Archdiocesan website. My number is 888-914-9149. A few tidbits of information for you. I thought this was interesting. Being half Hispanic myself, half Latino, I reject the term Latinx, which is ridiculous if you ask me. So it perked up my eyes when I saw that there was a poll done, a Gallup poll in the last few weeks, asking Black Americans, asking Hispanic Americans, various ethnic minority groups, how do you feel about the terms that are used to describe you? And chances are you may fall into one of these groups. So here it goes. This is from Gallup. Most Black Americans, 58%, do not have a preference between the terms Black and African American when asked which term they would rather that people use to describe their racial group. The one in three who express a preference divide evenly between preferring each term. So a third of those who are left, in other words, the 58%, roughly two-thirds, they don't care one way or the other, it doesn't matter. And the remaining third, about right down the middle, some prefer Black, some prefer African-American. So these findings, Gallup says, are similar to another Gallup poll tracking of Black Americans and what terms they preferred, but using a differently worded question. This goes back to 1991, and then again they did the survey in 2019. The new wording makes it clear that the question is asking what the group should be called, not how the respondent prefers to be referred to themselves. The earlier surveys also found majorities saying that it didn't matter to them which term was used, and usually no clear preferred term was identified among those who did have a preference. Although the term African-American was used as early as 1782, it was popularized in the late 1980s by a group of Black leaders who argued that this term had cultural integrity. But like Gallup's finding today, the Black public mostly had no preference between the two terms in the early 90s and the following decades, while similarly sized minorities preferred one over the other. Style guides of the Associated Press and the National Association of Black Journalists say that both Black and African American are acceptable terms, but not necessarily interchangeable ones. They advise reporters to use the preferred terms of their subjects. An interesting little detail here, footnote. I remember talking to a guy who was born in Egypt. Egypt is in Africa. And he was white, but he happened to be born there. It was a fluke because that's where his parents were living, I think, because of his father's job. He was white European of some sort, and he grew up in Africa, in Egypt per se. And I was talking to him, and he said that he had a little bit of fun when he got into the university because he listed himself as African-American because he had become an American citizen. And when they met him, they said, wait a minute, you're not an African-American. He says, yes, I am. I'm an American citizen. I was born in Africa. And I lived for many years in Africa. Well, but you're not African-American. So it's just really weird how the term is used. And I had never thought of it that way. What about somebody who is born in Africa like him, winds up becoming an American? So you can see how this could be very sensitive. Societally accepted terms do change over time, Gallup says. They found in 1969 that the term Negroes was the most popular term among Black Americans at the time, while colored people and Blacks were about equally as preferred, each by about 1 in 5, and Afro-Americans were favored by 1 in 10. Gallup primarily used the term Negro in early decades of polling, including in its very first question about Black people in 1939, though the term colored people was used as well. I'll pause here. When I was growing up, the phrase colored people, I thought, was derogatory. I heard it a lot back in the 60s as a kid. I heard people say that a lot, but I always had the impression that that was considered derogatory. Gallup says that, let's see, both terms were retired by the Gallup company in the early 1970s when Black became the staple term that Gallup used to poll about Black Americans after that. In the current survey, for the first time, Gallup asked a follow-up question of Black respondents who did not have a preference whether they leaned toward one term over the other if they had to choose. Black Americans were fairly mixed on the question, with a slight preference for Black, that's 52%, over African American, 44%. 4% had no opinion either way. Hispanic residents were asked a similar question about their preference among the terms Hispanic, Latino, and Latinx. I roll my eyes whenever I see the word Latinx. It's ridiculous. With this final option being a newer gender-neutral term favored by some Hispanic Americans, most Hispanic adults, 57%, say it does not matter to them which term is used, though nearly 1 in 4, 23%, prefer Hispanic, and 15% prefer Latino. Few expressed a preference for Latinx. I'm not surprised. Only 4%. These findings are fairly consistent with a differently worded question Gallup polled among Hispanic Americans in 2013 that also found that most said the term that was used did not matter, although Hispanic was slightly preferred over Latino. In the follow-up question, and this is the conclusion here, in the follow-up question in which Hispanic respondents were asked which term they leaned toward, most preferred Hispanic, 57%, while more than a third chose Latino. American language and terminology evolve, as do terms that certain groups use to refer to themselves. As for the term Black and African American, however, both terms have been accepted by most Black Americans for at least three decades, though sizable and roughly equal minorities of Black adults have had a preference for one of the terms in particular. Today, when they must choose one, Black enjoys a slight preference, although many opt for African-American as well. Most Hispanic Americans, too, are content with the use of multiple terms to describe their subgroup. Most favor Hispanic. Many prefer Latino. And very, very, very few have adopted Latinx, which is not surprising. So there you have it. You won't see me checking the Latinx box on my paperwork if ever I have to answer that question. Hispanic? Sure, no problem. 888-914-9149. We have a couple lines open. Why don't we start off with Darla in Madison, Wisconsin. Good morning, Darla.
Good morning, Patrick. I was wondering if you could clarify something for me.
Sure, I'll try.
In the past, I've heard you talk about praying with multiple intentions and that does not diminish the power of the prayer. And then earlier this week, one of your callers suggested adding intentions to the Memorare campaign for abortion. And part of your answer to him was that that would dilute the effort of the campaign. So could you, what have I misunderstood here?
Yeah, I see. I can see why that might seem contradictory. Okay, so in the first case, when I answered a question before, maybe more than once, about having multiple intentions, my point there was that it doesn't lessen the spiritual effect of the prayer. So as opposed to, say, praying for one of your children, if you're praying for all of your children altogether, let's say you have five kids, you pray for all of them, Lord, please protect my children. So that doesn't diminish, it doesn't dilute, in other words, the effect of the prayer. What I was referring to in the second question, which I remember now, was that it could, in the minds of the people who are joining us for this 400 million Memorare campaign that we're in the middle of right now, that if there's more than one or many different intentions that are listed in the minds of the people in terms of focusing on what they're asking the Lord for, it could have a diluting effect in their minds. So the two are not, in other words, there's no real contradiction here, because I wasn't suggesting that the effect of the prayers would be diluted, but rather people might become, I don't know, less keen on this if there were just multiple different various intentions. So the mind versus the effect, if that makes sense.
I understand. So the first one's the spiritual effect. The second one is more of a, people are possibly less likely to participate, perhaps, if it's less clear, less focused
might be another way to put
it.
You know, here's an example, and it's not an exact example, so there's some analogy going on here, but I remember hearing a priest giving a talk, and he said, and the talk was actually about the nature of marriage, but we won't get into that, but that's the context he was speaking in. He said he remembered being at a mass one time when the priest, it was on Mother's Day, and he asked all the moms to get up for a blessing, to stand up. And after all the moms had stood up, then he said, now let's get all the aunts to stand up as well. If you're an aunt, go ahead and stand up, or an aunt if you prefer. And then all the aunts stood up. Okay, let's get all the godmothers to stand up. Let's get all the women to stand. So eventually he had like all the women, regardless of their status. And who knows how many of them were not mothers in a strict sense, you know, mothers of children in a strict sense. And he said that it had a diluting effect, where this blessing that was originally intended for moms on Mother's Day suddenly became for everybody, and it had a diluting effect on the impression that it made on the moms. Like, I thought this was a special blessing just for moms, and now it's for everybody. And I never forgot that. I always thought that's an interesting bit of, you know, human psychology at work there. And I think that was partly why I said what I said about, you know, keeping the focus on the 400 million Memorares.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I'm going to continue piling on intentions for my daily rosary then.
That's great. I hope I'm one of them. Please pray for me and
Absolutely.
Everyone here at Relevant Radio.
Will do. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate it. Hey, did you know that CNN, everybody, CNN fired three of its employees who showed up to work unvaccinated? This is from Yahoo. CNN fired these three employees because they violated company policy by coming to work unvaccinated. CNN chief Jeffrey Zucker, he said, let me be clear. We have a zero tolerance policy on this. And this was for the whole company. The AP got the memo And they said there were no details on the firings or where the employees were based. Most of CNN's offices are already open on a volunteer basis. Voluntary, that is. Zucker said that more than a third of new staff members have returned. Proof of vaccination has been left to the honor system, he said, but that may change in coming weeks. I interpret that to mean that will change in coming weeks. The CNN leader said that masks are required in Atlanta, Washington, and Los Angeles. And there's a fairly lengthy list here of the things that they have to do. But the main thing is three employees showed up. They didn't furnish evidence of vaccination, and they got their pink slips, just like that. I have for you here also a little tidbit about how you can show your proof of vaccination if you're required to do so, and maybe when it is required to do so. This from the Wall Street Journal. Before you leave the house, don't forget to take your phone, keys, wallet, mask, and some form of COVID-19 vaccination record. New York City will require proof of vaccination for many outdoor activities, such as dining, gyms, and events starting August 16th. In San Francisco, already many bars require vaccine documentation for entry. Yelp, the app on your phone, if you use that, has announced that it will allow users to filter local business listings by two new attributes, proof of vaccination required and all staff fully vaccinated. If you aren't vaccinated, there are other reasons to consider it beyond this new damper on your social life. Your phone can already replace most of your wallet, your subway pass, credit card, plane ticket, hotel keys, and even soon your driver's license. It's a great place to store your COVID-19 vaccine record, too. Digital vaccine options vary from state to state. A national vaccine passport hasn't taken off in the U.S. yet, so states like California and New York are taking things into their own hands. However, going through a state-sponsored passport app probably isn't necessary, they say, as most establishments are likely to accept either your original CDC vaccination card or a digital scan or photo of it. Before you venture out, you want to get the card on your phone. And they have some examples here. So if this applies to you, and who knows, maybe it will apply to all of us in due time. But in the meantime, if it applies to you, they give instructions on how, if you're using an iPhone, how you can scan it and put it into a particular app, I guess. They also have instructions for Android phones. They tell you step by step what to do. They also tell you how you can find out if your state requires a passport. Some do, some don't. They talk a little bit about the Excelsior Pass for the state of New York. We have many, many listeners in the state of New York. You probably have been hearing a lot about this. They talk about how this is usually expressed in the form of a QR code and how you can store that on your phone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and all of the above. So if you're interested in this, then you might want to bookmark it for later use if this becomes something that is compulsory. But in the meantime, that information is there. And you'll find it, along with everything else that I discuss on the program, on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show, which is available by going directly to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. All right, we have calls waiting. And if you want to be on that list, just give a call at 888-914-9149. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back. We'll do more of your phone calls. I've got emails. I've got other news I want to share with you, including a new discovery that scientists have made with regard to black holes. They found something new that they kind of expected, but they had never seen before. And I'll tell you what that is when we come back from this quick timeout. Please stay right there. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, we're back. 888-914-9149. I got a chuckle, I guess sort of like wry humor, out of a way that this story was described. This is in the Wall Street Journal. One person described it as no jab, no job. United Airlines has announced they're requiring all U.S. employees to get the COVID-19 vaccination. This is in this morning's Wall Street Journal. United Airlines will require all 67,000 of its U.S. employees to be vaccinated by the fall It's the first major airline to take that step. Airlines, including United, so far have tried to encourage workers to be vaccinated voluntarily with incentives such as bonus pay or extra vacation. In a letter to its employees on Friday, CEO of United Airlines said that they expect that some would disagree with the decision, but the move is necessary to keep workers safe. A quote from the letter said, "The facts are crystal clear. Everyone is safer when everyone is vaccinated. Over the last 16 months, they have sent dozens of condolence letters to family members of United employees who have died from COVID-19. And they say, we're determined to do everything we can to try to keep other United family members from receiving that letter." So this is, extends to everybody in the U.S., and it will be mandatory. Now, they haven't said anything with regard to passengers. It's hard to say, you know, how that will shake out. But this is the first of the airlines to require this. And with things like baggage fees, remember what it was like when you used to fly back in the day and there was no extra charge for your baggage? You could check a couple, two, three bags even. And there was no extra charge where they realized they could make money on that. I remember talking to a person fairly high up in Delta Airlines, you know, up into the corporate world in Delta Airlines. He was on a flight that I was on. We were sitting next to each other. So I'm asking him about, like, what's it like, you know, in the airlines? And he says, well, it's all about margin. You know, you have to make your money on the margin for things like fuel and other things. How do you do that? I asked. He says, well, I'll give you an example. He says, years ago, you may remember that when you would get your meal, back in the days when you would get a meal, the salad would very often be sitting in a leaf of lettuce, a leaf of iceberg lettuce. And he said a simple example of this was where they eliminated just the leaf of lettuce. And he said it saved the company millions of dollars a year just by removing a leaf of lettuce that sits under your salad. So things like that. And the reason I bring this up is because if United Airlines has made this decision, as it has, to require all of its employees to be vaccinated by the fall, I'm quite certain that American will follow suit and Delta will follow suit and probably Southwest Airlines will follow suit because they study each other closely and they see if one guy gets an advantage or the other one has something that can make some more money or protect the situation that they have. Very often they all go in that direction in due time. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Lee in Houston, Texas. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for calling in today.
Hey, just wanted to thank you. Just wanted to touch base on an issue. So, real quick background: grew up Southern Baptist, fell in love with and married a Catholic girl, and having some kiddos. So now I kind of got to figure out what am I going to do with this. So I've been listening to a lot of debates, and I must say I think you are honestly the best debater I've heard on this issue.
Thank you.
I've never heard you get nasty or ugly like they all do, which just takes away from it's a waste of time. So I appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
So, but recently I was listening to a debate and the Protestant stood up and he read a quote, and you know, they quote a lot of church fathers, which obviously, you know, in my tradition, that doesn't really mean anything to me. Not that it shouldn't, but I don't, right. You know what I mean? It's,
I do. Yeah.
It's like a foreign language to me. I don't know why, you know? So anyway, he quoted someone or church father from history, and in that quote, I'm sure I'm going to butcher it, but basically it boiled down to you have to believe what the Catholic Church teaches about the Pope in order to receive salvation. And then the Protestant read that as like something bad, and the Catholic got up and was like, yeah, that's true, that's what we believe. And I was like, wow, I was really shocked at that.
Mm-hmm.
So just didn't know, is that accurate or like what?
Right. Well, it could be from a papal bull that goes back to the year 1300 or 1302. It's called Unum Sanctum. And in that papal bull, it refers to, it is altogether, I'm quoting from memory because I don't have it in front of me.
Sure.
But words to the effect that it is altogether necessary for salvation to be subject to the Roman pontiff. And it might be that document that
it does
the
sound
quoted.
Similar to what he said.
Okay. So that's part of a bigger issue known as no salvation outside the church, or in Latin, you'll hear Catholics refer to this sometimes in Latin, extra ecclesiam nulla salus. And that just means no salvation outside the church. So the essence of this doctrine is that, as Jesus said in Matthew chapter 28 in the Great Commission, he told the apostles, as you know, he said, go into the whole world, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I'm with you always, even until the end of the world. So going back even to the earliest of the church fathers who comment on that passage, you see that there's a recognition among them in the earliest years of Christianity that this was a mandate that Jesus wants all people to be members, formally members of his church that he established. And the church fathers, they rejected this notion that Jesus established Christianity as a kind of general religious group within which you could have various subgroups that agree on some things and not on others. They rejected that notion in favor of Christ established a particular church with a particular set of doctrines. And I believe that that is the Catholic Church. And so membership in that church is necessary for salvation. That was the teaching from Matthew 28 forward, at least as it was interpreted. And so over time, especially in the times when most everybody was Catholic, that when somebody would hive off and start a group that was considered heretical, and this happened a lot in the early church with the Arians and the Monophysites and the Monothelites and the, you know, all the ites out there that had their various versions, they were not only condemned in terms of their doctrine, but they were told that if you die outside of the Catholic faith, the Catholic Church, then you will not go to heaven. So this has been a consistent teaching from those early centuries. And when the Pope issued Unum Sanctum, he was doing so in the context of talking about this issue, talking about the Catholic Church being necessary for salvation. So it's a longstanding common teaching of the church, not anything new. Certainly wasn't new when he said this in 1302. But you'll see it reiterated again in the Second Vatican Council, which took place in the mid-1960s, well, early 1960s. And there, in one of the documents called Lumen Gentium, it says the same thing. It says that if somebody who knows that the Catholic Church is necessary for salvation and either refuses to remain in it or enter into it, that person cannot be saved. So the Second Vatican Council reiterated this teaching of no salvation outside the church. But it's intended to be understood against the backdrop of another truth that the church has always proclaimed, and we can see that in 1 Timothy chapter 2, where it says that God wills the salvation of all people. God wills that all men be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth, St. Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 2. So holding these two truths together, we can see that on the one hand, God desires the salvation of all people, and so there must be some way in which all people can be saved, could be saved. Doesn't mean that all of them will be saved, but there must be some way that they could be saved. Otherwise, God is willing something that's impossible, and that, of course, is impossible in itself. So that the church says that in a way that only God knows about, that he has not revealed to the church, that it is possible that those who through no fault of their own, and there's a term for that, it's called invincible ignorance, meaning from the Latin, unconquerable ignorance, or and to say it another way, that their ignorance of the necessity of the Catholic Church is not their own fault. And that could extend to many different kinds of people, you know, people who lived at a time in a place where it was impossible ever to hear about Jesus. They never knew, or they never heard about the Catholic Church. It could refer to mentally ill people. It could refer to people who have some malady that prevents them from understanding things beyond a child's grasp. Children themselves, you know, children who are below the age of reason. So the church recognizes that there are whole groups of people for whom this is not their fault. And so the church simply says the norm that Jesus established is to bring everybody into this church. Baptism is the doorway into the church, so to speak. And that's the normative way. And so that's why the church's missionary effort has been so strong throughout the ages, and that is to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ, to encourage people to be baptized and bring them in the way that Jesus said to. and then leave everything else in God's hands. So God alone would know the eternal destiny of those who, through no fault of their own, did not have this opportunity. Now, it's a huge topic, Lee, and whole books and multiple books have been written about it. So I can only give you that quick sketch. But that, I think, is the background to what you heard that person say in that debate. Does that make sense? A little bit more sense now?
It does. Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. Thank you for that. So just a quick follow-up on that if you have time, and if not, I can,
sure.
I can jump
No,
off.
It's fine. Go ahead.
So I guess the way I'm kind of approaching it, and I would like really like your opinion on that. So if I were to get, you know, hit by a bus tomorrow and stand before God, the way I'm kind of looking at this is, could I answer for the religious choices I'm making? And at this point, while I can see some points that I really never thought of listening to these debates, just Bible verses that made no sense that, mm-hmm. oh, like that's what you mean as a Catholic. So I could not honestly tell God that, oh, I think the Catholic Church is, you know, who they say they are.
Right.
I'm just, I mean, I could.
Are you asking, would you be saved?
If I joined. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I guess I didn't think that's what I was asking, but I guess I am. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the all important question for me and for you and everyone.
No doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. What must I do to be saved? So, of course, my answer is going to be that only God would know. He would judge your heart on the basis of what he knows to be true. I could only speculate, and I don't want to. But I will say this, that if you suspect that maybe the Catholic Church, I didn't think so before, but now it's starting to look kind of more likely that maybe the Catholic Church might be that church that Christ established. I've still got issues I've got to work through. And I still have questions, and I still have some objections.
My mail.
What was that?
I said, it sounds like you're reading my mail. you know what I'm thinking.
Okay. I had a hunch. So I'll just put it that way then. If in your heart you're saying, well, I'm leading up to an answer that might surprise you. If in your heart you're saying, I never used to think the Catholic Church was the true church, but now I'm not so sure. In fact, I'm really beginning to wonder because I'm seeing some things, my eyes are being opened to some things. And if you suspect the Catholic Church might be true and yet you stifle that or you say, not going to do it. And you refuse to discover what may in fact be there. I believe it is, of course. That too would qualify as somebody who rejected salvation. It doesn't mean that you have to have a crystal clear, absolutely well thought out, complete understanding of the Catholic Church and you say yes to it. That's not necessary. That's helpful, but it doesn't often happen. And so in the case of somebody like yourself who suspects it may be true but refuses to find out, I would say that would put you in that same category of the person who just rejects it altogether. But on the other hand, here's the good news. If that's where you are right now, then I would look at that and say, Lord, if this is you, if you're really prompting me to discover more, even though at first it was kind of a horror story, I couldn't believe I was actually even thinking about the Catholic Church. But if this is really you, then please guide me and show me what I need to know. And I will be open to your will. And that, of course, if you have that attitude and you get hit by a car tomorrow, I would say you probably go to heaven. You know, all other things being equal. I mean, if you die in the state of loving God and being sorry for your sins, trusting in him for your salvation, and you also have that attitude of, Lord, I'll go wherever you want me to go. And I didn't think it would be the Catholic Church, but maybe it is. And if that's where you're leading me, then show me the way. You see, that attitude or that disposition would be on the plus side of things.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Patrick.
You're welcome. Hey, real quick, before I go, and I do have to take a break, have you ever read a book called Surprised by Truth?
No, I've heard of it.
Okay, let me recommend it to you. It was published in 1994. Now, all, you know, full transparency, I edited this book. But it's a collection of 11 testimonies of people who used to be evangelical Protestants. Some were, you know, a couple were Calvinists. Most were Baptists. But in any case, they tell their stories about why they became Catholic, and I think you would find it very interesting because a lot of the issues that I'll bet you have are the same issues that they had. and they kind of walk you through how they looked at the Catholic Church. So just a thought, if you want to read it, I think it'll shed some more light on things. Surprised by Truth. Get the edition that came out in 1994. It has a red cover. I think you'll find it interesting.
I'll plan on finding it. Thank you.
All right, Lee. Thank you. Call me again sometime. I'd love to talk to you. I'm going to take a break, but I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. And no, I have not forgotten. I am going to share with you what scientists have detected behind a black hole. They thought it might be there, but they never saw it before. And now they saw it, and I'll tell you what it is right after this.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. This is the Patrick Madrid Show. Thanks for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. Okay, as promised, this is from CNN. Scientists have detected light from behind a black hole, and it fulfills a prediction rooted in Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity. For the first time, scientists have detected light from behind this black hole that they've been studying. Stanford University astrophysicist Dan Wilkins and his colleagues observed X-rays that were released by a supermassive black hole located at the center of a galaxy that's 800 million light years from Earth. Mind-boggling. These bright light flares are not unusual because although light can't escape a black hole, the enormous gravity around it can heat up material to millions of degrees. This can release radio waves and X-rays. Sometimes this superheated material is hurled out into space by rapid jets, including X-rays and gamma rays. But Wilkins noticed smaller flashes of X-rays that occurred later and were different colors, and they were coming from the far side of the black hole. Any light that goes into that black hole doesn't come out, so we shouldn't be able to see anything that's behind the black hole, said Wilkins. He says, however, the black hole's strange nature actually made the observation possible. The reason we can see that is because the black hole is warping space, bending light, and twisting magnetic fields around itself. X-ray flares have been seen from the far side of a black hole for the first time, as depicted in the picture that's in the article. You can take a look at it. They published the study last week in the journal Nature. 50 years ago, the article says, when astrophysicists started speculating about how the magnetic field might behave close to a black hole, they had no idea that one day we might have the techniques to actually observe this directly and see Einstein's Einstein's general theory of relativity in action, according to a co-author of this study. Einstein's theory is that gravity is matter warping space-time, and this has persisted for 100 years now since he first proposed this. As new astronomical discoveries have been made, some black holes have a corona or a ring of bright light that forms around a black hole as material falls into it and becomes heated to extreme temperatures. This X-ray light is one way scientists can study and map black holes. As gas falls into a black hole, it can spike to millions of degrees. This extreme heating causes electrons to separate from atoms, which creates magnetic plasma. The powerful gravitational forces of the black hole cause this magnetic field to arc high above the black hole and twirl until it breaks. I mean, this is like beyond imagination, if you ask me. But this is the stuff that's on the whiteboards with the marker pens on in research labs all around the world. They study this stuff. So it's just amazing to me that an object that is 800 million light years, in other words, the distance it would take light to travel over 800 million years, that we have the capability to sit here on Earth and look at that, and then look at stuff behind that. What's on the other side of that? And we can see that too. It's just incredible, if you ask me. So if you have a kid in school who's interested in science, this might be just the thing for that child. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Christian in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Christian.
Hey, Patrick. Wow. Ed, this is, it's great to be on with you.
Thank you. Welcome aboard.
I've listened to you for a long time, and I thought, you know, one of these days I should call in. I have to say that Michael Knowles, in one of his shows in the last couple of weeks, had mentioned your name as being instrumental in his development in his Catholic faith, and I've always appreciated his ability to move from cultural topics and political topics into the Catholic faith. So yeah. My hat's off.
Michael is a genius, if you ask me. Very well spoken. I like him a lot. We've had a chance to get together a few times, and I'm very much his admirer. And I didn't know anything about this, but all of a sudden I was getting texts from people all over the country. Hey, did you hear Michael Knowles mentioned you on his program? So that was nice that he did so. But he's a super guy.
I
like him a lot.
That's great. So my question is, it's vaccine related. I follow the Charlotte Lozier Institute's update on the COVID. I'm reading it right now. COVID-19 okay. Vaccine candidates and abortion-derived cell lines. Last time it was updated was June 2nd. Still haven't found any abortion-free vaccines that I'm aware of. And I'm not a scientist, by the way, so this is all, I'm reading this as a layperson. But I reached out to an epidemiologist and a parent expert on vaccines, Kuldoff, I'll find his name momentarily here.
That's okay. And we don't need that. Just give me the essence of what you want to talk about.
I'm at a point in the world when there is a vaccine that has not used aborted tissue, aborted children. Have you in your circles run into any ways that a person like myself or others who are willing to get a vaccine, but not until it's free of aborted fetal cell lines? I've tried vaccine.gov, I've tried CDC, and nobody has any answers.
Well, here's what I discovered early on. Number one, I'm looking at the same chart. Well, if you're looking at the chart on the Charlotte Lozier Institute website, you'll notice that in the column for development and production of the vaccine, Moderna and Pfizer are free of any taint of aborted fetal stem cells. It is, however, the case in the testing, so not the derivation of the vaccine. So the vaccine itself is free of any direct connection with aborted fetal stem cells, thank God. Now, on the lab testing side, some of the testing that was done after the fact included the aborted fetal stem cells. So that is problematic in that sense, but it's not directly in the vaccine itself. Now, others, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, for example, they are the only one, and this is, I think, is the answer to your question, the only one that I've been able to determine is free in both cases, as far as I can tell, at least the last time I checked, was the Sanofi Pasteur vaccine, which is a European pharmaceutical that has worked on this one, and they have no connection with aborted baby stem cells. And I checked with a high-level physician, and when I say high-level, I mean he's the corporate medical director for a major, you know, like Fortune 100 company. And I asked him, is it possible to get the Sanofi Pasteur vaccine in the United States? And he says, no. I mean, if you were in France or Germany or some other place, you might be able to get it. But it's not available here in the United States as far as he was aware. So that one particular vaccine, I know for sure, at least at that time when I last checked it, it did not have any connection at all. But getting it is the trick.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's super helpful. And thank you for that. I've even considered, shoot, I'll just schedule a vacation and go somewhere. And I would imagine I need to check through what the heck do you call them? It's where ambassadors come from, embassy.
I know what you mean. Here's the thing, though. Getting to the country where the vaccine might be available nowadays could be a real difficulty. Because if you're not vaccinated, so take Israel, for example. It's not in Israel that I'm aware of, but you can't even go there. You can't even book a trip there because they won't let you in, especially if you haven't been vaccinated. They won't let you in. So I would advise, especially if it becomes necessary in terms of a government mandate or for some other reason, just follow the teaching of the church. The church has at the highest level, all the bishops of the United States, they've all said that you are not doing anything immoral at all if you receive the vaccine, the two aforementioned, Pfizer and Moderna, which have no connection with aborted fetal stem cells in the development and production. It's only in testing. Now, that's bad enough, but it's not bad enough to make it immoral to receive this vaccine. And all the bishops have said this, and the Pope has said this, and the CDF has said this, and the National Catholic Bioethics Center, which is not magisterial, obviously, but they concur with this. So I think that you're on safe ground if, for whatever reason, if you do have to take one of these, that you're not going to be doing anything immoral or illicit by doing that.
Patrick, thank you so much. I'm really grateful for the time and your thoughtfulness and your reply, and I'll keep going on the track that I've been on, and if indeed I'm up against it, I can fall back on what's been said in the church. Yeah. So thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you, Christian.
I'm really grateful for you.
You're most welcome, and I reciprocate. Good on you, as they say down in Australia. 888-914-9149. Victor in Atlanta, welcome to the program.
Welcome, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Question about a conversation you were having the other day in reference to the salvation of unborn
yes.
or aborted children. And you mentioned the fact that God was all sovereign, more or less.
Right.
That under those certain situations that, hey, I mean, God can do what God wants to do, really. And under mm-hmm. certain circumstances, you know, he may wish to give a waiver or reprieve or whatever you choose to define it as. So I wanted to ask you, what about extrapolating even further down the line and say someone who may be Hindu or Hindi or Muslim mm-hmm. or Buddhist, and maybe their life path or their life experience just so happened to take them down that religious way to worship, would it not be possible for the all-powerful to also give a reprieve or waiver in those instances as well, since, as you said, he is all-powerful?
Yeah. Well, in the sense that I think you mean it, of course, God, as I said, who is sovereign, he is not restricted by the sacraments. We're bound by the sacraments because this is what Christ commanded, but God is not bound by the sacraments. So he can give grace however and to whomever he wants. So the short answer to your question is yes, he can do that. I think the next question becomes then, does he do that? And I think the answer is yes, but this is something that has not been revealed to us as to how. So to go back to my earlier point from another conversation in the show earlier today, in 1 Timothy chapter 2, you know, it begins in verse 1, I urge you to make prayers, supplications, petitions, and thanksgivings for everyone, for kings and all in authority, that we may lead a quiet and tranquil life in all dignity and devotion. For this is good and pleasing to God our Savior, who wills the salvation of all men, that they come to a knowledge of the truth. So to use that as one example in Scripture where it speaks about how God desires the salvation of everybody and he wills it, doesn't mean that he commands it. He doesn't command that any given person, well, I don't want to go there because that gets into the question it gets into the question of predestination. But for the moment, let's just say God wills this. So there must be a way that it's possible. It has to at least be possible. Otherwise, God's willing something that is impossible, and that's contrary to his nature. So in this case, I think we can safely say that it has not been revealed to us who and how, but that God can do this because he wills the salvation of all people. And I think the church's position on this is that God does do this. but it's unknown to us, you know, how he does it. So I'll put it one other way, Victor. There is no Muhammad door to heaven. There's no Buddha door to heaven. There's no Moses door to heaven. There's no any door to heaven other than Jesus. As Christ said, he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So Christ is our unique soul mediator. There's no other way to heaven except through and in Jesus Christ. Now, that extends to his church, as the Catholic Church says. The church is necessary for salvation. But this is the norm, and God is not bound by the norm. So I think at this point I'd probably be repeating myself. But it's an important topic, and you know, naturally people are wondering, well, what about that nice Hindu guy that I know? What about him? Well, the church says he needs to become Catholic. He needs to be baptized. He needs to come to faith in Jesus Christ. That's what he needs to do if he wants to be saved. At least that's the preliminary. But what if he dies in the meantime? Well, then we say, well, only God knows. And we have to, what's the old saying? Work as if everything depended upon you and pray as if everything depended upon God. I hope that helps a little bit, Victor. I've got to run, but thank you for the opportunity to discuss that. I appreciate that. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show and your phone calls right after this. The number is 888-914-9149. By the way, science has made another discovery that corroborates something in the Bible. I'll tell you what that is when we come back.